Resource Committee, please come to order.
Present are Senator Lincoln, Senator Sharp, Senator Taylor, Senator Lehman, Senator Green, and myself. We have confirmation hearings starting on our schedule with Alaska Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. Mary McDowell, would you join us? Not that we haven't seen you for the last close to 20 years around here. Would you give us a brief resume?
For the record, I'm Mary McDowell. I'm with the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. By way of background, I have a number of things I think in my background that have kind of prepared me for this job. I have hands-on experience in the fisheries. I've provided fish buying services in the community of Angoon for 18 seasons in the past, which gave me hands-on experience working with fishermen and understanding how important the fisheries are to those fishermen and their families, and experience with writing thousands of fish tickets and handling fish and so on. In addition to that, I served as a legislative staffer for 16 sessions, including 4 years with the House Resources Committee, 2 years with the Senate Fisheries Committee, and then worked on a number of fisheries and related issues in the other years as well. Following the legislative work, I most recently spent 3 years working on fisheries issues in the Lieutenant Governor and Governor's Office before kind of joining the Entry Commission. I think that particularly as a quasi-judicial agency with quasi-judicial functions, it's important that entry commissioners are fair-minded and objective and have a real understanding of how fisheries work, are able to work with all kinds of people from diverse backgrounds and cultures, and understand how the law works and how fisheries management works. And I think those are all things that I bring to the job. I think the Entry Commission is an important agency, and I take the job real seriously.
Questions by members of the committee? Senator Lehman.
Mary, I appreciate the work you've done over the years in fisheries issues. And yet, I look at your background, at least your immediate past background, working with Lieutenant Governor's Office and Governor's Office. Maybe your role was, a very technical one in fisheries issues. But a concern that I would have would be any using a position, a public member on a commission like this for political purposes. And I guess my caution to you, as it was to Cammie when she came and talked to me, was resist that to your fullest if that ever happens. I hope it never does, or that you would be requested to do that in your position. But if it does, resist it and protect the public interest and while you're there. And that, I have no reason to believe otherwise, that you would conduct yourself otherwise, but it would just be a caution that I think it will protect the commission, it will protect you, and protect everybody that gets regulated by that commission.
Absolutely, thank you. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree that the independence of the entry commission is absolutely crucial.
The only other thing that I would say is the only strike that I can, other than what I comment I said is being careful, is the strike against you is that you're replacing a very good friend of mine who I think served well on the commission and did a good job of filling a public position, and he has said some very fine things about you. Mr. Chairman, I'll just note for the record, in case it's an issue to somebody who may want to review the record of this meeting, that I may be perceived as having a conflict. I'm voting on this.
You get that? You definitely do.
No.
And I think you should be. And I think you should be careful voting.
I forget what color it is this year, but it's, I have one of those plastic cards. It says 1998. I already paid my dues for this year. I wasn't thinking of the senator from Wrangell when I was saying, in case somebody might want to make an issue of it.
Well, I'm sure that I have a conflict of interest because getting this job gets her out of the governor's office where she's been working so hard against that good bill that I've been trying to get passed.
Well, that's not what I consider political. That's just bull.
He agrees with it.
It's just technical competence.
Senator Sharp, how many... Yeah, this is a little out of my ability. How many people are on the commission? Five?
Three.
Okay.
Full-time.
Three full-time paid commissioners. Georgiana?
I'm sure we don't have to declare it, but I also have the exact same card as you do. I'm sure as...
You don't have the S04H card.
I've got a 98 as well, so just to put that on the record.
Oh, hey, we might control this vote.
There's nobody here that can vote on this, Senator Halpern. I'm sure sorry.
It's the four of us.
Yeah, I know.
Question with regard to one of the considerations that has gone around in this legislature for a number of years, and that is an enforcement system that would, by record of the permit holder, in essence, devalue the permit as their record of violations increase. Some kind of a point system or a number of violation system. If you've got, you know, two violations in the last 2 years, it may not be as worth as much on the market because if it has three, it's revoked for 3 years. That kind of a system.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that would work in terms of the commissions being able to deal with it? I don't know that there's a bill on this side. It's something that I strongly support. It's not anything I have a bill in on, but I think there's a House bill on the topic.
There is a House bill. I think it's 285, and it was heard today. And the commission's been working closely with the committee on that bill to try to come up with one that would be enforceable and workable. I think they've removed the part that would actually devalue the permit as it goes. Demerits would accrue until it kicks in at a certain point.
But if the violations travel with the permit, mm-hmm. Somebody who is an aggressive line fisherman who thinks he might get caught would pay less for a permit that has only one more strike
mm-hmm.
than a permit that still has three strikes. I don't mean that the right. commission necessarily does the devaluation, but I think the marketplace might do the devaluation if the...
Right. We would have to keep track of the demerits, get the, mm-hmm. the information right. from public safety and the court system and keep track of that. And we've been working with the committee on it. If that's the way a bill comes out, we'll certainly work with it. We can make it work, however.
The commission can make that kind of thing work, in your opinion?
We've looked at it several ways. It's tougher to do if you have the traveling demerits with it. You'd have various kinds of permits. You'd have to notify at every transaction. You'd have to notify the potential buyer that this is kind of a permit with strikes against it. You'd have to have a computer system that could keep track of all of that. As every time there's a demerit, you'd have to keep track of that and notify everybody. So it'd be considerable work involved.
But wouldn't the potential buyer, be wise to check the record of the permit he's looking at buying? Is it your obligation or is it the buyer's obligation to know what he's buying?
Well, someone would have to keep track of each permit and what it has against it.
Right.
And that, I think, would be our responsibility to know, to keep track of
mm-hmm.
what points are against that permit.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you just have the fisherman just saying, oh, my permit, I've had this many violations and my permit will have a few points missing when you go to get it.
Yeah, you definitely have to have some kind of tracking mechanism. Maybe.
Right, but it does create another disincentive for violations.
Another topic, somewhat related, in the Supreme Court cases that have dealt with equal access, that have referred sometimes obliquely, but definitely to limited entry, there has been at least some statements made in those opinions that the primary reason that limited entry is not in conflict with other provisions of the Constitution is the conservation section that allows for the elimination of permits. And it's been a long time, and I wonder
Do you see any danger to the system in a constitutional challenge because we've still taken virtually no action to eliminate permits?
With the buyback program in statute, we've actually spent a lot of time looking at the buyback provisions, but there's a lot of interest in buyback right now. There are two substantial problems, as I understand it, with the current buyback statute the way it is. One is the fund being committed, the dedicated fund problem, the way the current statute is set up, that it would be a dedicated fund, and there of course would be legislative ways to get around that. And the other is, as you point out, the Johns case and the equal access provisions. There have been Supreme Court cases that have pointed out that there are ways that where we could add permits to fisheries, but it's very difficult to take them back out. And if you did take permits back out of a fishery, if there was a challenge later on equal access, you might be forced to put them back in which case you've spent that money to get them out. And there are problems with it. And we're looking at it closely, and we'll be happy to work with people on those issues, but there are both statutory and constitutional problems that make it difficult. But.
Well, it just seems that unless something is done at some point, I think the justification that the Supreme Court used for holding that limited entry was constitutional will no longer be there. I don't know where that point is, but I think it should be a significant consideration.
Yeah, I'll be happy to look at it further, work with you on it.
Senator Taylor?
Yeah, Mary, thank you for being here, and I appreciate the fact that you're willing to take it. One of my frustrations with the commission for the last several years has been that as emerging fisheries developed, and even some of our existing smaller fisheries began to expand, first we started talking about and sending rumors out about moratoriums or about some limitation, which immediately started a gold rush for those permits. Then we would stumble through the process of getting a moratorium going, then finally make some decision about how people acquired points so as to secure a permit. And each of those, in my opinion, have been almost a disaster in the way they were handled. They were, if I go back to salmon fishing permits, when we first started into this process, there were people excluded that had been fishing salmon for years, but through the happenstance of circumstance, more anything else. And then as we ran into the various other fisheries, the most recent was the Dungeness crab mess, and took two or three different pieces of legislation before we finally cleaned that thing halfway up, and it's still not, in my opinion, very realistic. And the most recent is the shrimp pot debacle, where we end up starting off with a fishery that's 150 or so people, and by the time we get done scaring people over it, we end up with 300 and some people signed up to get permits. How are we going to get around that? I mean, is the commission ever going to start acting like a commission and going out and saying, this is a limited fishery, we are exercising the authority we have, and we're going to do it based upon some logical, realistic basis? Or are we going to just say, oh, we think we ought to do this, maybe somebody in the legislature will do something, and then it takes a 2 or 3 year staggered process during which every frustrated school teacher that wants to become a fisherman runs out there and immediately buys 10 pots, and all of a sudden you've got another flood of plastic around. I know you've watched this. I know you've been frustrated by it, just as many members of the industry have, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, I appreciate the frustration. I think there's several things that the emerging fisheries right now are developing so quickly, and some of these, as people are in trouble in fisheries and looking for ways to supplement their income, or places like in the Wrangell area where they're suffering from an economic downturn and turn to the shrimp fisheries and so on, where a lot of people get into things quickly, and the moratorium statutes are so cumbersome that as they stand right now, it's very difficult to react quickly enough. The procedure is slow and cumbersome, and it's hard to react quickly when something's happening that fast. And limited entry statutes were designed with salmon fisheries in mind, so they're hard sometimes to apply to some of these other fisheries, pot shrimp and so on. The commission does have a bill before the legislature right now to streamline the process for a moratorium, which I think could be helpful in some of these cases where the process itself could be implemented much more quickly. The problem of the threat of limited entry, the threat of a moratorium happening and several years later going limited, is that speculators do jump in. So you do need to make it where you can get in there. It's a problem we saw in halibut IFQs, where there was this big lag time between the qualification dates and the limitation, and a lot of people got hurt in the meantime. And under any scenario, limited entry has trade-offs. There's people will lose out to some degree, and there are people who won't get in, and that's one of the painful parts of it. The state, the voters, and the legislature over the years have decided that the trade-offs, getting a cap on it, keeping a limit on it, keeping outside folks from leaping in when their fisheries collapse, and having stabilizing one of the variables in fisheries management, knowing how many people there are, you know, the decision over the years has been that those trade-offs are worth it. And I think it's important for policymakers to continue to look at the program and see if there are ways where it can be improved.
What are your plans on the shrimp pot thing?
Well, that fishery has gone limited now, and the permits are being distributed. Over half of the permits, I think it's about half, of the ones going out in that fishery will be non-transferable. So over time, it will weed it back out again. As those people retire or choose not to fish, those permits can't be reactivated, so that will whittle down the numbers.
Okay, so those that bailed in late on it will have a non-transferable
Most
permit?
Most of those will have low points and be at the non-transferable end.
Points will be based upon years of involvement
in the
fishery,
participation,
and volume, and so on?
Right. So a lot of those newcomers who jumped in to speculate, if they get a permit at all, will end up at the non-transferable end.
Okay, so what we're looking at maybe is some expansion over the existing fleet. If we were to carry this thing out 10, 20 years, some expansion over the existing fleet, but not the doubling or tripling
right.
that was taking place.
Right.
Why should any permits be transferable?
Well, again, I think that's something the legislature struggled with when they enacted the limited entry statute. My understanding is that the main reasons for that were that it was a way of establishing a system that would be constitutional, would meet interstate commerce laws, and still favor Alaskans, basically. That it was a way to grandfather in participants and a way to have permits change hands and still be slanted towards Alaskans. That the only entities that can use permits as collateral for purchase of permits themselves are CFAB and the State Division of Investments, and only Alaskans are eligible for those loans. So it was a way to help keep them Alaskan. More than 77% of permits are in resident hands still today. So it's been fairly effective at making a system that would do that.
What percent of the total gross permit value is in Alaska resident hands? I think it's a substantially smaller percentage than 77.
The fisheries that tend to be extremely high Alaskan participation are the smaller boat fisheries. I'm sure that's true, but I don't know what the value answer would be. I know that one of the other arguments the legislature used in enacting this was that people who have a financial stake in the fishery may have a larger interest in the long-term health of the fishery and sound management over the long term. Another one of the arguments used at the time, is my understanding.
Well, with this most recent one, was the decision that some permits are transferable and some are not made by the commissioner or by the legislature?
The legislature, by statute, established, gave the commission the responsibility to determine what constitutes a significant economic hardship and what's a minor economic hardship if that person were to not get a permit. And so in establishing point systems, the commission goes through and figures out how a point system based on years of participation, quantity sold, consistent participation, did that person sell once or throughout the season over those years, and do they own a vessel so they have an investment, and all those sorts of things. In some point systems, it's comparing their income from this fishery to their overall income and so on. Once that point system is set up, then you rank all the participants and you figure out what constitutes a minor. That person would not be hurt very much by not getting a permit.
Well, I'm not talking about getting a permit. I'm talking about getting a transferable permit versus a non-transferable permit.
And the law says that if they hit the minor economic hardship level, that permit would be non-transferable. They would not suffer significant economic harm by not getting a permit. It kicks into the minor economic hardship level, non-transferable. In some fisheries, you've got so many applicants that you don't get down to that level before you run out of the number that's being distributed in that fishery, so you never get to the non-transferable level. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, just so that, I mean, I'll say it again. I will not vote to help in any way creating any transferable permit to add more artificial value to the debt load of fishing communities.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, the way I think the high-value permits are going, either the legislature or the voters by initiative will repeal transferability of permits.
Mm-hmm.
And we have argued so long in IRS that they have the right to do that, it'll be hard to argue that they can't.
Well, that's a policy call for the legislature, and we'll carry out whatever the laws are.
If you do, you'll be the first agency I've seen in 3 years.
Are there further questions? Could we have a motion to end the standard letter?
So moved. Good luck, Larry.
Without objection, we will send the standard letter to the body on Mary McDowell. Thank you very much.
Good to see you.
Board of Game. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairman Halford, Vice Chairman Green, Senators. First, I'd like to thank all of you for the charity and helpfulness of your staff this morning, this afternoon. In my wanderings through the building, they were very helpful to me. My name is Bob Churchill. I've hunted and fished since I was 10 or 11 years old. I was raised in rural Washington State, where hunting and fishing were a part of daily life. My father and grandfather were both active hunters. I moved to Alaska in 1986 and have had a hunting and fishing license continuously. And for the last 3 years, I've also had a trapping license to allow me to be able to take fur bears when I hunt. As far as my qualifications for the position, I sat on the Anchorage Advisory Committee for approximately 7 years. Approximately three of those years, I chaired the committee. I've also been actively involved in a number of sporting organizations throughout the both statewide and in the Anchorage area. Also, in part of my professional life, I'm an operations manager for the Postal Service, and in that position, I've traveled throughout the state. I had the southeast area for a period of time, and now I'm assigned to northern Alaska. When you travel, as I know all of you know, I think the education you receive is extremely helpful. Also, I, for probably 4 years, worked as an arbitration advocate, where I part of that job is gathering, analyzing evidence, and I think that's been very helpful to me in the position I've been acting in the board for approximately the past 4 or 5 months. I was asked to share with you why I would want to be appointed to the Board of Game. I think what it really all melts down to is I've hunted all my life, my family has, and I really want to pay back the benefits I've received. I think hunting is in a position of where it needs strong advocates, and I think it teaches good life lessons to those people who participate in it. I'm happy to make that a part of my life and continue to participate in it. The other thing is, I think if we don't encourage the preservation of our ability to hunt, if we don't continue to let people know the value that it has to those that participate in it, we may not be able to enjoy it in the future. Thank you.
Questions by members of the committee? Senator Lincoln?
Thank you. I appreciate you coming before the Resources Committee to answer any questions that we might have as well. The Alaska Resources Consulting group that you are the owner and consultant for, what is that group?
Basically, it's not a group. I am the group. I've done an awful lot of work in labor relations and human resource aspects, and about 3 years ago I had people requesting me to give them some assistance, so I went through and put a business plan together and established a business, although last year, due to time constraints, I really didn't have a lot of activity in it. That's essentially what it is. It's consulting with different small firms that can't really afford a human resources staff and need help. It's a complex employment world out there for many small businesses.
And as the, if I might continue, Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. And as the manager of the post office operations, you know that the Board of Game meets so frequently and for quite a lengthy period of time, that is that something that you're planning then to work out with your employer and your consulting you as the owner of the group, that you would be able to spend that kind of time on the Board of Game?
Before I accepted the initial appointment, I sat down with my family first and then my employer, and I am confident that I can in fact do that. I've been with the Postal Service a long time and have enough vacation time, and I think it's important enough that I'm more than willing to do that.
If I might have one more question. I noticed that you have worked in Southeast, and you say the interior and the North Slope. Have you hunted in those areas as well? And what kind of hunting do you actually do? Is it big game hunting? Or
I do some moose hunting. Most of the hunting that I've been able to do probably in the last year and a half has been more small game, upland birds and that sort of thing. But no, I have not hunted in that part. As far north as I've actively hunted have been up in the Fairbanks area. But it's all been within walk off the road system. I haven't done any either in units 23 or 26.
Just a follow-up on that question, if anybody else doesn't have one, what areas have you hunted in since you've been a resident?
I've hunted the Kenai Peninsula. I've hunted the Greater Anchorage area. Hunted most of the Parks Highway. Obviously not on those highways, but
what kind of success?
Fairly good. Are we going to get into the specific locations? No.
I'm not asking for your single place.
Not for birds.
Vice Chairman. Senator Lehman, then Senator Sharp.
Bob, we, a few days ago, got into discussion in this committee about Game Management Unit 13 and the off-road vehicle challenge and what the board is doing. Do you have any thoughts about what should be done with that situation, or even if hunters are causing a problem and it's something that should be addressed by the board?
Yeah, I do have comments. I'm glad you asked. Greg Rositska and myself were asked to co-chair a group of hunters regarding ORV use in Unit 13. This flowed from a lot of proposals the board received. We've met twice, and where we've come to point is it seems like there's a real lack of education among particularly new ORV users. It doesn't seem to be, from the information we've drawn for those that participate, it doesn't seem to be a problem of folks maliciously getting out and tearing up the countryside, but we do have a lot of folks new to hunting, new to ORV use, and many don't seem to be familiar with some of the techniques of using them. So what we've talked about as a committee is the possibility of working with the ORV industry, possibly putting a video together that teaches good basic techniques in using ORVs. We've talked about working with the Department of Transportation to increase the number of spots where folks can park and take their ORVs in. I mean, one of the things that seems to be generating a lot of usage on a limited number of trails is that there's only so many places you can park your rig and take your ORV in. So those are the types of things that we've seen. The other thing is there doesn't seem to be a good general knowledge of the phenomenal availability of ORV trails. So those are some of the things we've looked at. Clearly, there doesn't seem to be any evidence to support this is strictly a hunting issue. But I think we're doing some things that will be helpful. And between education and some of the things we've talked about of gathering data will allow us a number of years down the road to make some fairly solid decisions as it regards to ORV use. And it's so critical to be able to access some of our areas.
Senator Sharp, are you on the same topic? Or?
No.
Let me follow up just to ask another question on that topic. Do you believe that the regulation of methods of access is one of the ways that the board should use to control the level of harvest?
In certain circumstances, I think it well could be used. I think it's probably more easily dealt with by seasons and bag limits, but being relatively new to it, I would think there may be some instances where that would be used. I couldn't give you a specific example at this point.
What about allocation between hunting groups? In other words, some people tend to advocate regulation of ORVs or whatever they don't have. If you have an airboat, then you don't like other access. If you have horses, you don't like other access. If you have airplanes, you don't like other access. It seems that there's an awful lot of the biology of self-interest involved in the debate that you hear on why somebody else's method shouldn't be allowed.
I'll tell you, both through the advisory committee and the short time I've been on the board of game, I've seen a fair number of proposals that says, you know, you can hunt anywhere, but the 200 acres I like best. And I, if I'm getting your question right, I think we have to stay away from that. We can't start tipping the scales that way.
Senator Sharp.
Well, just for information purposes, how many board meetings have you attended since you've been appointed?
Meetings of the full board.
Participated in them.
Yeah. Nome, Bethel, the ORV meeting, so three, I guess.
Senator Green.
Yeah, your name's familiar. Didn't we receive a lot of information from you last year?
Yes, regarding probably Nicole Evans, you bet. Nicole Evans was a member of the Anchorage Advisory Committee. She was before you folks before the legislature for confirmation for a position on the Board of Game, and I supported that nomination. Nicole worked for approximately 2 years on the advisory committee, and I know there was a lot of concern about her feelings about consumptive use, but I saw and watched her vote, and she voted consistently for consumptive use, both when it came to hunting and trapping. So, yeah, that was the position I took then.
Senator Taylor.
Well, you've kind of led into it, Bob. Consumptive use and management of predators have been very volatile topics, and I'd like to hear your views on it, if you have any.
Yeah, I do. When I first joined the advisory committee, one of the first things I was involved in was a predator control plan. And the Anchorage Advisory Committee put one together that looked at different geographic areas and dealt with issues like predator pits. And it's very simple. Predators in the state of Alaska eat an awful lot of ungulates. I don't think there's any question about that. And in some areas, there's an awful lot of wolves and bears eating calves. And if we want some of those populations to recover, they have to be dealt with. One of the interesting things I found and was kind of surprising to me was that in order to really make a reduction in a wolf population, you have to knock down over 60% of that population, or you're just kidding yourself. So it's a complex issue. Wolves are probably the easiest predator to deal with in terms of control. There's groups within the state that have managed them locally for a long, long time. Bears are a little more difficult because of the difficulty in counting them and their reproductive cycles, but all things that have to be addressed if you're balancing a system. I don't see any other way to deal with it. The other predator that you deal with, that particularly with caribou, or eagles take a few of those, and I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole.
I might take the stress off of wolves if we start. Your eggs are good.
This is on record.
He's just heard that. I guess my concern is the board at one point attempted to implement a policy that was never carried out by the executive branch on predator control. And then through administrative delay and slow rolling as much as anything else, we then end up with a board that apparently has now come up with a different policy. And I'm curious as to what that policy is and how effective you think it's going to be, especially as concerns the economics of utilizing helicopters to locate and then tranquilize and then surgically neuter wolves as a process. That apparently is the only thing I can get my fish and game to do these days for the wolf.
Well, not to be evasive, I really don't understand that system. The only systems I've dealt with or even looked into have either involved hunting with rifle or actively trapping. I don't know. I don't think, from what I've been able to read, there's enough evidence to clearly establish what's going to happen with relocating wolves or neutering wolves. I just don't have enough information at this point to have an opinion one way or another on it. Sorry,
I think these are going to be, without a doubt, I think some of the most controversial things that the board will face, and I think it's incumbent on us to at least kick these things around a bit. When we're looking at $12 a barrel of oil, the idea of having some group of fish and game people chartering a helicopter at a very expensive rate to fly around and play games with wolves doesn't impress me much as far as an efficient or economic management tool. And I really don't want to see somebody on the board supporting policies that can't be justified economically and are highly questionable biologically. And I guess I just want you to be aware of that and to know that those are my concerns.
Well, if I guess to speak directly to those two issues, I think we have to be biologically driven, and I think we have to be economically conscious. It's like I was talking about earlier with the ORVs. I mean, one of the things we've explored as a committee is to how can we get some of these things funded without dipping into the state coffers, and that's an orientation that I think is important, particularly in today's government.
If I might just finish up with that. Without dipping into the state coffers, there's a group of us that took out a significant number of wolves on the 40 mile, and I believe we had an impact on that herd. And now I find the Department of Fish and Game tried to explain it away, and they keep using numbers with me like they do with you, that, oh, you haven't really done anything unless you take 60% of the wolves out. Well, maybe somebody, one of those guys from Fish and Game, ought to go out and tell the 40 mile herd that. Because we did see a significant increase in that population, or survival of those calves that year, last 2 years, in fact, and I don't think we took 60%.
And I'm not going to argue, but if it wasn't 60%, I'd think it was pretty close.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was an extremely large number of wolves that were trapped, if I remember correctly.
Senator Lincoln?
Mr. Churchill, I noted that on your resume here that you have held a hunting license since 87 in Alaska.
Yeah, I moved up in 86 and wasn't eligible for a resident license until 87.
Okay, I guess when I saw the U.S. Postal Service, I was thinking you were a resident since 73. So you've been a resident since 86?
86, moved up in late April. I believe early May.
And you have held a trapping license for the last 3 years. Are you a trapper?
No, what I took a class last winter, and I'm thinking about getting into traps and trap running a small trap line. But I buy that so I can take fur bears when I hunt.
Mm-hmm. So you haven't actually been out on a trap line then?
No. Mm-hmm. No.
Further questions? Senator Taylor.
What are your views, Bob, on using the Fish and Game Advisory Committees in solving issues that come before the board?
I think it's a great way to get good information from the local communities. I guess that most of that is from my personal experience with it, but I think when you start drawing information from communities and the average citizen shows up at a lot of those meetings and gives you their heartfelt opinion, and then it gets reduced to writing. I know when I go through, we have a book we're given at each Board of Game meeting, and I weigh those very heavily. I go through them, and if there's a proposal dealing with a particular area, and the Fish and Game Advisory Committee locally has got some good information, and they often do, it's certainly... helps me to make a decision. I know in Anchorage, we used to have people come and testify. We had one fellow who was a brown bear guide for over 40 years on Kodiak, and we had some fairly difficult proposals to deal with. He spent an hour with us, and I think allowed us to come down well on those issues. So I think it's great. It's all volunteer. Minimal costs with those on the road system. I know there's costs on transportation where you don't, but from what I've seen, I think it's a good return on value and gets you good information.
What's the projected cost per wolf for this sterilization program?
You know, I've seen a lot of numbers, but I couldn't tell you.
And I thought, wasn't that voted on since you've been on the board?
It was
just approved.
You know, I can't answer. I believe that 40 mile plan was something that was worked out prior to me coming on the board. The only thing I remember, there was a request for an agenda change that I know has been offered since I came on the board, and that's the only thing I can remember voting on as it relates to that 40-mile plan. That was the trappers in the Caribou Calf group that requested an agenda change.
Senator Taylor?
Yeah. It seems to me that over the last few years, the board has had a habit of treating every complaint that comes in as if it's a, quote, chronic conflict. That seems to be almost a word of art anymore. And this has led to a proliferation of poor, or I don't think rather than poor, probably unnecessary regulations in an attempt to correct this. And I guess I'm looking for someone that will provide a reasonable definition, at least within the board, as to when something has reached such a chronic level that it needs a regulation. It seems like anybody that comes in and complains, that one complaint becomes a new issue for a regulation to be passed. And I guess I'd like your thoughts on that, too. You've only had three meetings, but maybe you've seen it yourself.
Well, I think I have with the ORV issue. I think there was a number of organizations and people that tried to portray this as a chronic conflict situation. Board met, we took testimony. I can't remember anyone getting up in front of us, testifying, or providing us any information that came close to establish any kind of chronic conflict. And I think that the course that we've tried to take with that has been to address it. I don't see any regulations flowing out of the committee that we've established. I think we're trying to deal with it in a way that addresses the issues that we think are important to address, and to do so fairly forthright. And then it's fairly clear that if somebody needs to establish a conflict, they've got to do so with some good information, other than one or two people portraying it as conflict. I mean, if it was that big a conflict, if I remember correctly, we had approximately 100 people testify before the board, and out of that 100, I didn't hear any that either characterized or provided enough information to raise to that level. So I guess to the bottom line, when just a mere verbal assertion that a chronic conflict exists isn't good enough. You need to really get into it, talk to the people, and find out what the issues, if any, are.
Further questions? If we have no further questions, could I have a motion on the standard letter? Senator Sharp?
I defer to the Vice Chair.
Senator Green.
I would make the appropriate motion to move its individual recommendations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You guys have been really nice.
Before we get there, we got nominations to Board of Gamers. Two other members' slots that have expired, 1/31/98, and I'm wondering if you have any more.
Not that I know of. This is the only one that we...
What is the procedure there? You've been here longer than I have. Do they continue serving until replaced, or are they gone?
No, they don't.
They can't.
They're gone.
Yeah.
So the board is short two members as of the end of this month, or the end of last month?
Yes, that's right. Holmes and Sampson are up for reappointment.
And the governor has not made any decision on either of those, or either of those positions? Okay. Thank you.
And actually, I'm Diana Cody, the executive director of the Board of Game. Members actually do serve under statute until they're either replaced or otherwise appointed.
Okay, so you're not short then. Okay, thank you.
What you saying? They're not one?
They serve until they're replaced.
Well, they do?
They said they're reappointed.
What'd you do? Leave and take a walk on that?
I mean, it's not.
You reappoint before the end of the session.
Okay, Board of Marine Pilots, Peter Bere, that's the proper pronunciation.
Pretty close.
As I always say, the Board of Marine Pirates.
That's pretty close, too.
Well, that starts it off. Well, is there any questions?
For the record, my name's Pete Gray, and I'm a member.
Have an eye patch.
Go ahead. Member of the Alaska Marine Pilots. The pilotage district that my group services is west of Kodiak Island to the end of the Aleutians, on up to the Canadian Arctic border. To give you a little background or intro on myself, I see you guys got the resume, so I'll go through it pretty quick. Linfield College, a BA in political science. on the back deck of a dragger for about a year. Had enough of that, so I applied to Cal Maritime Academy and was accepted. Graduated from the academy with a third mate's unlimited license. That license in itself, being big, was really just my ticket to learn. I sailed deep sea for about 15 years, third mate, second mate, chief mate, master, captain, and then pilot. Some of the jobs that I held when I went up through the ranks were on various container ships, tankers, dredges, bulkers, tugboats, fishing vessels. A lot of it was in Alaska. Early on in my career, I worked with Sealand when they still had their C4s running up in the Cook Inlet. I worked with West Coast Shipping on the T2 tankers, the Lompoc, the Santa Paula, which is a T4 tanker. I've been to Drift River, Christie Lee, over to Nikiski. I sailed on the VLCCs between Port Armuelas and Valdez with Keystone Shipping as second mate, so I've had experience in and out of Valdez. My tugboat experience took me back and forth up through the southeast part of the state. I've had offshore experience sailing around the world as on bulkers with a company called Liberty Maritime Company. I worked on two dredges, the Essence and the Aquina, on the west coast as a second mate. That was kind of a prelude to getting into the piloting business because I did a lot of ship handling on those. My last ship command was the Ocean Phoenix. That's about a 680-foot factory mothership that operates in the Bering Sea. And that was really the platform that started me in piloting in Alaska. For me, it's an honor for this appointment. I look forward to participating in the discussions which promote a safe and efficient system of marine pilotage in the state of Alaska. I've got some pretty big shoes to fill. Mike O'Hara was on this board for 8 years. And I think to his credit, he did a good job. As most of you will remember, this was quite a controversial board in 91. Mike worked through a lot of real big problems. I am inheriting a whole different board than what Mike is leaving. Things seem to be working fairly fluidly and smooth. There's a framework around this board, which I'm finding we're resolving the problems. The handoff, if you will, between Mike and myself seems to be going fairly smooth. Mike continues to come to the boards. We talk afterwards and exchange information. I think that's important to continue with the continuity in the board. I think basically the system is starting to work, and I think it's starting to show some fruits of that. Some of the projects that I've been on two board meetings now that we're working through, our competency assessment and pilot performance evaluation. Now, these are substantial projects in that I think they'll make a better product. And considering what's at stake in marine pilot in terms of commerce and the ramifications of a marine mishap, we've got to have the best out there. And in the past, pilots could go for 20, 30, 40 years and have a tool bag on their side and no one ever looked at it to see if they kept them sharp. Well, I have to agree. I think it's time that that tool bag's opened up, and occasionally they go in and sharpen them up. We've made significant progress on that. There's an RFP, is that right, request for a proposal out for the simulator part of it, and we've had real constructive discussions about the performance evaluation and how the each pilot group will implement that. I would have to say, what I would like to bring to the board is just continued steady at the helm. I see a lot of good communications going on between everybody, and to help facilitate those communications. I believe that my experience and background is favorable and will help this process continue ahead. And I enjoy the process. I've been part of it. One more thing. I've been part of it since I was a pilot in 91, going to these meetings. And, you know, I always remember when I first came here, we asked, geez, all these problems, let the state fix it, they'll take care of it. But after a while, it came to me that the people in the state are people like me. And I realized it was important for people like me to be involved in the affairs of their business, particularly when you have the experience in the background to you know, participate in the dialogue that takes place. About it. Questions?
What do you think about single port pilotage in Western Alaska?
I don't think that'd work because a lot of the ports have sporadic traffic patterns to where a ship will come in or a group of ships. Let's take Togiak, for example. For a three-week period, there'll be 20 ships there. Then there won't be anything there for the rest of the year. The canneries are similar to that. They're in the crab season. I just got back from the Pribilofs. There'll be 6 months or 6 weeks of intense activity around the island. Then that'll be it. Summertime may see one or two cruise ships. There is, I should say, only one port that sustains year-round steady pilotage, and that's Dutch Harbor. That's really the nucleus of our whole region. Everywhere else is peaks and valleys. Kevalina, which is, you guys have heard about, the new Arctic port coming online, that'll be summer months only. So does that answer your question?
Well, the reason I asked the question is to see if there was anything that could be done to try to provide some benefit to local people. I mean, there are people in those port communities that have been operating barges and small vessels for years and years and years and know their ports very, very well, but they have no interest and would never have any ability to serve as pilots in any other place. The system that is region-wide makes the process really unreachable to any of those people. Although, I don't disagree that the business is not something you can make a living at, but it might be a part of something you could make a living at and live in one of those communities as a local resident. That's why I asked the question.
It's a long, long road to get to be a Marine pilot. It took me 4 years at the Maritime Academy, a couple years on the back deck of trawlers, and 20 years of sailing to get the experience. We have some programs that are in place. I don't think they've been used yet, the apprentice program, to where you could take an individual that's got an entry-level license and put him into one of the pilot programs. Unfortunately, there's nobody out there that we've found in Western Alaska that's got the entry-level license. That's a 1600 license. That's a significant hurdle. Most of those people don't or haven't taken the opportunity to get that license. They're not given the opportunity. Unfortunately, you hear about the factory trawler program that employs the locals. Well, they employ them in the bowels of the factory ship. They don't have a chance to move up into management. It's like employing people down in the fields to pick strawberries. They're never going to run anything. They need to enter into this profession at a mid-management level, and that's where they're getting too blocked in terms of finding an opportunity to get that initial 1,600-ton license. If they could get that, and I always advocated the way to do it is to go to the Maritime Academy. It's a wonderful opportunity to come out and, as I said earlier, to learn and to move in any direction you want and move up. Problem is, when you walk on the bridge of a ship, it can be Korean, Russian, Japanese. There are a number of significant things that require a broad range of experience to conduct that vessel safely. That's a hard one to put my finger on, but when I walk onto a bridge at night, I know whether they've been drinking. A lot of times they have, and I have to make a decision, what am I going to do? I know if there's a problem with the communication on that bridge. I know if there's a problem because the captain's Japanese and the crew is Filipino, and they hate each other. And all that affects how well that job's going to go. And when I dredge an anchor up to a dock that was made for 50-foot fishing vessels, and I'm going to put a 300-foot ship alongside that without the benefit of a tug, I better make sure what I'm going to get when that captain gives orders to the chief mate. And generally, it's not 100% of what I ask for. It's 70, 60, 50, 40. I have to make that call. I think I'm able to make that call relatively accurately because of my broad range of experience of having been on a number of ships. But I agree with you. I would love to see some of the folks in the Western District get involved. But the breaking point is getting them in a mid-management and getting that initial license. No one's come to us with that license.
And there is no... Is single port licensure prohibited by state law?
Yeah, I think it is. What you have to have is regional coverage for the whole district. We had a district, the Kuskokwim, and that was a single port. there was only one guy that could do the work, and I understand he's no longer doing it, so.
Well, I just think that's something that, you know, there's some legitimacy in single port licensure. If it can work to try and get local people, local knowledge, particularly with regard to river ports.
The what?
River ports.
The river ports? That would be the Kuskokwim, right? You know, we're going to have to address that one.
It may also be the Yukon. It may even be come up the Nooshigak into Dillingham. I mean, any place that you've got a, you know, the questions of local knowledge versus the questions of ship handling kind of weigh against each other. And obviously, you need both, and that's what the problem is. But do you need both for everywhere if you're going to live X place and you've been there for the, you know, your family's been there for the last 10 generations? Maybe there's a opportunity there if you have single port licensure. There'll never be an opportunity as long as it stays regional.
Mm-hmm.
And it may never work anyway. I just think we ought to try. I just want to put that in the equation. Other questions? Senator Lincoln?
Mr. Gary, I couldn't see on here when you moved to Alaska.
Oh, 1990, Homer, Alaska.
So you moved your family up to Homer?
Everybody, yeah. Lock, stock, and barrel.
Is that where you reside now?
Yeah. That's my only residence. No vacation home, no anything anywhere else. I'm full-time Alaska.
Further questions?
Move the nomination.
We have a motion on the standard letter of consideration. Senator Taylor, you've made the motion for the standard letter. Are there objections?
No.
Without objection, so ordered. That brings us to Michael White, I believe, is on teleconference also for the Board of Marine Pilots.
I am.
Same process, same questions, same answers?
My answers would not be as good as Captain Gray. He has more experience than I do. I assume you have resumes. Just briefly, I moved to Alaska in 1979 after graduating from law school. Was an assistant district attorney in Anchorage and then district attorney in Nome and Palmer. I was appointed in 1984 as a judge in Anchorage, and in 1987 went into private practice of law, which I still do. I'm interested in the Marine Pilot Board. My practice has been in and out of various maritime issues, and have wanted to get back into public service. I was honored that the governor appointed me. I'm prepared to answer whatever questions you have.
You are a public member on this board?
I am.
You said you've been interested in this area. Does your practice bring you into this area, or in what way?
Not really, but the only exposure in my practice, and it was very indirect, I represented the family of a Marine pilot who was killed in a plane crash. The representation really didn't deal with Marine pilotage issues, but learned a little bit about the area in that, and also when I had worked on the state's legal team on the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And it became very apparent to me how important it is and to the state that Marine pilotage issues be handled well.
Was that a Pen Air Goose?
It was.
Questions by members of the committee? Senator Taylor?
I know Mr. White personally and have a good regard for him. If nobody has any questions, I just move and get on to the next one.
The only question I would have, and I'm sure he understands that he's kind of at an arm's length from this profession as a member of the board, of course.
I do.
That's really all that I would have.
Yeah, having been a judge in the past, pretty familiar with ethical considerations and take them seriously and understand that. The governor's office certainly went over that with me during the appointment process.
Well, I thank you for your interest and willingness to serve. Do we have a motion for a standard letter?
So moved.
We have a motion to advance the standard letter on Michael White to the body. Without objection, that letter will go forward. Now we have the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The floor is yours.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, I also wanted to extend a thanks to all of you and your staff for the courtesy of having the opportunity to visit with all of you ahead of time. For the record, I will repeat some of my background. I first moved to Alaska in 1977, and in early 1978 went to work for the Alaska court system in Petersburg as a clerk of court and acting magistrate. It was after a number of years of working there that I was looking at pursuing further graduate work, and I was encouraged to go to law school. I returned to the state and continued my employment with the state, first with the court system and then with the Department of Administration as a public defender, and then with the Department of Law, where I worked representing the state's oil and gas interests, the different divisions in different departments, both the Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources, and in the summer of 1995 was appointed to represent the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. In the limited capacity in which I represented them, I became familiar with a lot of their background, including their budget background as well as their history in preparation for that lawsuit. And I subsequently accepted the nomination for the public member seat and began work at the commission in the fall of this year, middle of September. My experience at the court system in Petersburg as an acting magistrate and the training that I received from the court system gave me some background in independent thinking and careful analysis of all of the facts in any case that come before you in making decisions. The advantage of the three-member commission is that you have two other people that you can work together with at reaching a decision, and it's a successful process, I believe, that I have some background that gives me a foundation to work with. I am enjoying the work very much. I have some basis from my experience at the Attorney General's office in the oil and gas field, although I admit I have a lot to learn, and I'm looking forward to it.
I hate to admit it, but there's some places where legal education is probably a good thing to have. You've got a geologist and an engineer. Although, I don't know, I think the elementary school teacher will help you in dealing with
both of them.
Questions by members of the committee? Taylor?
I'd move the nomination.
Are there objections? No. Advancing the standard letter without objection. Ordered, and it is done.
It manages to be the last.
Now that we've done that, I have a question. Kevin,
go ahead.
Thank you. I might have asked you the question before, but when you were serving in Petersburg, were you there at the same time that Senator Taylor was on the court, the district court at Wrangell?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Halford. I mean, Senator Lehman, yes.
How'd you get along with him?
Fair question.
I think it's fair to confess that it was Judge Taylor who encouraged me to go to law school.
Mm-hmm. Well, I met Judge Taylor before he was Judge Taylor in Ketchikan, and he encouraged me to go to law school. He encouraged me to move to Anchorage.
All I encouraged you to do was leave town.
If there's no further business to come to the committee, we are adjourned.
Thank you.